Your check, your cooperative. As a farmer-owned lender, Farm Credit Mid-America shares the success of the cooperative with our customers, which is why we've returned more than $1.5 billion back to our customer owners over the last 9 years. It's proof being a part of our cooperative pays. Patronage is an annual decision made by the board of directors to return earnings to eligible customers. To learn more about patronage and eligibility, visit fcma.com/patronage.
Okay, motherfucker!
What are you looking at, sir?
Well, I'm looking at you, miss.
Run that, baby.
I'm not the Zodiac. And if I was, I certainly wouldn't tell you.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome back to One Heat Minute Productions. I'm your host, Blake Howard. Today, I'm not talking about a film, strangely enough, but I am talking to two filmmakers. I've got Alexi Mizzen and Ryan Van Dyke, who have just written a real banger of an erotic thriller series on Australian screens on Stan, or 7, 10, and 9, if you're a psycho and you know what it actually stands for. And it's an amazing film reference, movie reference laden, entertaining, erotic thriller series that is for adults and creeps out adults in the best way possible. And I want to compliment them both by saying, I started watching your series and my wife is a great barometer for good TV or just good movies because she is usually blatantly disinterested on the couch when I turn something on the television, doom scrolling as you do as a parent late at night. And it wasn't too long before the phone went down and we were transfixed by watching you. So firstly, congratulations on the 6-episode series concluding its run locally in Oz. I'll talk to you guys more about how people can see it internationally. But how are you feeling? How are you feeling now that it's out there, guys? Thank you for coming and how are you feeling?
Thanks so much for having us. And very excited to hear that we got, you know, a chance of maybe getting people off the phones. That's like the aim. That's what we're trying to do.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's awesome that it's all out, that finally we can talk about the ending and we can give it over to the world and see what people make of it.
Lexi, how are you feeling? Yeah.
I feel good. You know, I feel like relieved that it's done. You know, it takes a lot of work to kind of post about it every day, not every day, every week, talk about it every week, hear all the reactions, the positives and the negatives. So I'm glad that, yeah, it's out there and we can just, you know, sit back and see what people think of it and concentrate on what's next.
Yeah, I suppose it's really tough is because some folks might not understand like how protracted things are when you produce anything creative, which is like, this has probably been an idea with you guys for years. You write it, you make it, you're then kind of at the whims of a schedule that you then have to put out and you guys want to get on with other stuff and you're constantly being dragged back. And because it's 6 episodes, it's not just like, okay, here it is. See you later. It's like, oh no, here's a whole series and here's billboards and here's hot topic conversation and you guys are going to be involved in it. But look, you should be really proud of it. I think it's an excellent series kind of top to bottom. I've got lots of questions for you, but I want to ask like, where did the idea start? Because I think people of our generation who like the first early adopters of places like Airbnb have heard about horror stories of the Airbnb owners filming people and having those sorts of things happening. I'm sure we've probably all shared and we've got some mutual friends. So maybe they've shared with us like creepy things of people on Instagram or whatever, because we're of a certain age, may not use TikTok, but it's like, that's where the adults are watching all your TikTok, whatever they are. So like, where did this idea come from? Was it you guys wanting to tell this kind of, I guess, surveillance erotic thriller merger in a new voice because of our unique voice from Australian perspective? Or was it like stories that you heard? Like, what do you remember what that moment was? Or it was like, oh, this is an idea that we want to pursue.
So we've like been obsessed with, you know, tech for ages. You know, we've always wanted to write a tech thriller, you know, obsessed with surveillance and kind of, you know, the paranoia that comes from that. But this one came to us as a book, which is always interesting when the, that when the idea is presented to you, we always have our own ideas that we're pursuing, and it's nice when somebody sort of brings something to you that's like really interesting and scratches an itch and is really fully formed. So yeah, we got brought the novel by J.P. Pamer, and immediately knew that there was something really interesting in there, something really topical and really sort of paranoia filled that we could get into.
Yeah, that's right. I think JP, the book is called The Last Guest, by the way, which is an awesome book. And he really cracked onto this sort of insightful idea that, like, yeah, you enter a person's house and you think you're safe, and you can, look around and realize that there's cameras all over the place, and it's terrifying, So we started sort of thinking about that and just like trying to figure out what kind of story this device lends itself to. And we've always been, obsessed with erotic thrillers. We're kids of the 90s. We grew up on all those Michael Douglas, Richard Gere movies. And so we thought there's a really neat way to package those two ideas together and go for something that's a little bit different to what you see on, especially Australian TV, in terms of the erotic element of it, but also something that was very us and very timely and just spoke to all the anxieties that we ourselves kind of go through day to day.
It's funny when people like there was a big gap. And I think because we were kids of the 90s, like Australian TV took this massive, like conservative bent where the idea of sex and sexuality, like just like evaporated from our screens. But Australian television, like exploded internationally with something like Number 96, which is basically, if you've never heard of the series, it's a famous series where just everyone is shagging each other relentlessly on this show, and it kind of like made a massive splash. So it's actually quite a relief to come back to like 2025 and you guys to go back to that kind of like very what bloomed in the 90s in cinema, which is like, oh, it's an erotic thriller series, because it's like moviegoers, cinema goers, and someone like David Fincher always says, like, in our heart, cinema goers are like perverts, and I completely prescribe to that theory. But I think TV goers, it's funny that we haven't cracked it. I was so pleased to see you guys tackle it, because it's like all these serial killer shows made by the Ryan Murphys of the world are like glamorizing all these serial killers. They do a lot of this awful, sometimes violent and sexual shit mixed together, and they're just kind of like, and I'm just like, well, can't we just have sexy people being attractive on screen? I know that your series delves into the darker edges, but it's like also just beautiful people being attractive, having dalliances. That is an attractive, you start an episode with like a dalliance, and it's like, oh, well, this is something. This is a show. This is like, you've at least captured my interest before you completely twist it and make it creepy and freak the living daylights out of your viewers with that kind of premise. So, that's really cool.
It's so cool that you bring up David Fincher and David Fincher making movies for sickos and Gone Girl being like the
Oh
feel
yeah.
bad movie of the year, or what was it, like the date movie, like
Yeah,
the
that was
perfect date movie, the
he's had a
perfect
few.
terrible
He's
date movie.
like the very like he's had the Christmas one with Gone Girl with the Dragon Tattoo, which I love the pieces and watch every year religiously around Christmas time. But yeah, like it's that there is sort of something about like sex and titillation and violence and spectacle that like actually does grab you, and then you've got to build a great story around it that'll capture people. Because I know for me, I'm a relentlessly impatient TV viewer. Like if I watch an episode and it's like an hour long and it doesn't get me, I'm like, I'm really sorry. You guys can see because we're talking like this is one of 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 shelves that are in my office right now. And so there's a lot of cinema that is out there that I need to consume. I love, yeah, that you're turning your camera around. I can see lots of
Just
physical
angling
media.
to my, yeah, I'm also obsessed with collecting physical media and making sure that I have every copy of the thing that I want, because you just never know when it's going to drop off streaming, and then you're never going to be able to show it to your whatever friends or spouses or whatever.
But
Yeah,
yeah,
it's
so
interesting, like that sort of blend of sex and violence, for us, kind of, it goes back to Hitchcock, really. Like that sort of those early days of blending the two together, and it's so salacious to mix those things, and it feels so transgressive. And we were entering, I guess, a very rich history of those kind of stories, and it's been through all of these different iterations throughout the years. And yeah, we knew that sex and violence was really good, material to get people hooked and to get people off their phones and watching. But you're so right, you still gotta layer in your twists and try and keep people hooked episode to episode.
That's it, yeah. And I think, like, to your question about like why we tend not to do that many erotic thrillers in Australia, I think, partly because we never had sort of the avenue to do it. Like you had the free-to-airs that would never touch this kind of content, and suddenly you have the Stans and Netflixes of the world, and thank God for them. But I think the other element of it is they're just really hard to do. Like the actual physical craft of shooting these scenes, it's like, shooting an action film, you just happen to have two people in the one room. Like that's how long it takes and how much you have to consider it. And you don't want to make it a mindless action scene. You want to make it a scene that tells a particular story. And so for us, it was a really interesting challenge to come up with those scenes and then hand them over to the directors and the actors to kind of convey what the story meant to convey, and for them to kind of go as far with it as they can, as they could. It was really awesome.
I love the pacing of the series. So, six episodes. It feels like, and I don't know if this is intentional, maybe it's just my interpretation. Like, it feels like the events of the first few episodes are like happening very quickly. There's like, it feels like it's happening over a few days. And what was so kind of cool is that the last three episodes feel like they're like a month each, or like there's like a month in between them, or there's this imperceptible amount of time, but it's not like you guys are going a month later, like there's not a silly chevron that comes up on the screen. And I really liked that call because it's like in some of these sort of twistier moments, you want to get to a resolution. And I just love that the way that you tackled this book and approached the adaptation was like, well, this might protract out and it might have all these other avenues, but we're just gonna like the first part of it is like a week, those first three episodes. It's a very chaotic, lots of new things, lots of big feelings, lots of culminating storylines of all these characters before they've even arrived to your show. And it's like they're all coming up to these moments of decision in their life and these turning points. And then it accelerates because that's the other sometimes like infuriating and frustrating thing with longer series that go for like 20 episodes. You're like, oh my God, now we're gonna have a five episode flashback with this character, and then it's going to be another three episode flashback with this character, and it's just like so much. And I really think the chops of the series, the biggest compliment I can give you is that it had a lot of like movie storytelling instincts in it, in that like we know that you're going to be ravenous and anticipating a conclusion here, and we know that time must pass because that's part of it. But was that in the breaking of the novel when you guys were adapting it, was that like, okay, like the, however much of this is going to be there? Because that was so fascinating for me watching. I was like, I was trying to put it back together in my head in preparation to talk to you. I was like, it feels like the last three episodes are like 3 months, but the first three episodes are like 7 days. Like that's, and I was like, I loved that. I loved not knowing. And if you don't want to talk about it, you don't have to tell me, but I just was wondering about
No.
that approach.
Love talking about it. I think, like, first of all, it's so nice to hear you say, that you found it really propulsive, because that was really, before we started making the show, the challenge that Ryan and I set ourselves is that we wanted to make a show where you don't need to hold back a big turning point till episode five, that I feel
Yes.
like a lot of shows do. And then you get that, full episode flashback because, you're waiting for them to hit you with it at the end of the episode five before you go into the climax. And so we thought, if we can get to a big twist, let's get to it, and then we'll just figure out what happens afterwards. We can continue telling the story. And, the challenge with that is that, it does become a really breakneck pace. And so the first three episodes are really fast. And we knew when we were sort of looking at the overall format of the show that there needed to be a reset. And
Yeah.
that's why the second half does take that break and almost starts the second movie of the show, the second half of the show. And I think, there was a challenge to that in terms of telling the story, but I'm really glad that we kind of went for it.
Yeah, this idea that it's kind of like two movies put together, it felt really got organic on a couple of levels. Like, the first is that the show starts off as a whodunit, and one of our sort of pet peeves as viewers with a whodunit is the idea that, you'll easily fall into a structure where your main character interrogates one new suspect every episode, and you can kind of start to tune out in episodes 2 through 5 because you're
Yeah.
pretty sure that it's not going to be any of them, and that you'll get to the suspect. It'll be the last person that the character has on their list, and you know that'll be the show. And so we, you know, came up with this idea of like, what if we promise people a whodunit and then we blow it up? You know, what if you get to the end of, for people who've seen the show, kind of the second episode.
Yeah, second
And
episode is like, that was like my whole, like our family on the couch. Holy shit. Oh, because my thought was, not knowing too much about the premise, not knowing too much about the original book, this is me being fresh to it, watching it with you guys. I was like, they got 4 episodes to go. Like, what are they
what are they
gonna
going
do?
to
What are they gonna
do?
do? And then that made me more excited because, like, oh shit, they've really backed themselves into a corner now. Now this is where they really get to show off. That's what I thought at the time.
That's what excited us, is like, as kind of viewers of the show, would be like, we just love the idea that, and people have reacted this way of like you said, like getting to the end of the second episode and going, what are they going to do now? Like, what is this show going to become? And that was like incredibly exciting. And then, you know, in terms of like kind of the halfway point, you know, we were kind of inspired by, like, I feel like it was maybe like LA Confidential or something like that, where you get to the midpoint, or you get to a certain point in a mystery story, and the main characters go, cool, I've solved it. The movie's over. I'm moving on with my life. The story has ended. And that like really thrilling sort of crime trope of going, wait a second, the story's still going. I just didn't realize it. And that moment in those movies where the characters sort of have to go back through all of the evidence and go, what did I miss the first time? And you know, kind of resurrect the engine of the film. And we thought that would be an incredibly exciting format to sort of to put in the show, and yeah, and just keep the audience guessing from episode to episode.
I love it. You use LA Confidential because that's the perfect one. It's like the whole, they're going along, they do it. You guys had multiple Rollo Tomasi moments where it's just like, oh shit, that just happened. Now what the hell is going to happen? And then there's this sort of, like I said, this sort of imperceptible passing of time in the latter part of the series where it's like, oh, there's just people have sort of settled into the reality that you guys set. But everything is still bent out of shape. Like you can almost like it's like a wheel that's not aligned, or a record that has the vinyl is warped or something. It's just like every feeling of every character is like something is off. It doesn't feel like you've got peace. Like I feel like in a lot of whodunits, it's like when the hard truths come, there is something peaceful almost and tranquil in the realization that you've solved it. But you guys kept just like scratching. It was like something was still there and it wasn't perfect. And you're like, oh, what the hell is this going to be?
And kind of putting Lena into that position that the audience is in, which is like, this, it just feels like there's something that I can't quite put my finger on that is not right, and I'm going to try and ignore it. But you know, in episode 4, she's starting to go, there's just something here. Like, there's something that I need to interrogate. I need to pull on this thread, and it might just run out of it straight away. And sure enough, you know, the mystery keeps unraveling.
Yeah, I think like it just speaks to like generally the nature of coercive and abusive relationships, right? Is that sometimes you don't realize just how wrong things are, but you do have that feeling, whether whether it's yourself or whether you see a reaction from a friend in a real life scenario where you go, we're all playing kind of happy and everything seems fine at this dinner table, but something doesn't feel right. And I think, yeah, trying to echo that in the storytelling, like I'm happy that that comes across in terms of the mood and the sort of the feel of the show.
It's funny because I feel like when you're younger, especially when you're creative and you guys are putting yourselves out there and putting your creativity out there, and in my small, modest way as a crea adjacent creative, you put yourself out there with stuff. And when you're early, when you're young in both relationships or careers, like you have instincts. And I feel like sometimes like the status quo says, trust, no, it's fine. But what's so cool about your show, I think, is that whole thing of like, no, just trust your gut. Something's weird. Like, it's like there's something cool about going like, oh no, I call it, I know this might sound gross or lurid, and I know we're talking about a show where there's lots of sex and people watching people. I just call it the smell test, right? Like there's just something, you get into a room, I don't know if you guys have had this experience, and you meet someone and you go, something's wrong. I don't know what it is. And you're not smelling the person. I just mean like figuratively. So I think when I say this to some people, they expect me to be like, you know, very creepy. Unfortunately for Josh Helman's Dan, like smelling someone. That's not what I mean. I mean, just like there's a smell test. It's something's just like, no, it's something that is sensory where you're like, no, there's something wrong. That there's something that doesn't pass the muster here. And it's funny when you get intoxicated in early relationships, and that's a big part of the story. We obviously meet Lena, the great Aisha Dee in the show, and her partner Kane Chai Hansen are having some difficulties. There's been some life, you know, challenges for Lena, and she's been hesitant about taking that next logical step. And Kane is in a rush and has pressures from his in-law, you know, from his parents to like make this all happen and get to this next phase of their lives together. And Dan comes along and it's this beautiful, sweet, fake, unreal, too good to be true, intoxicant. And so I know sometimes you turn those off, but it's almost like just once that mist lifts, the smell's still there. Like the this is wrong. Something is wrong.
It's interesting. Like in writing, we have this whole thing that sometimes, like, you always reach these parts in a script that are really hard, and there's always this temptation to start something new because, that phrase that it's easy to start something new than to fix something. And I
Yes.
feel like kind of where she is when we meet her, like there are tricky things that she's navigating with her history, like her deep history and her recent history. They're definitely not on the same page, despite there being a lot of love there between her and Kane. And then Dan is this new thing, and it's kind of it's there and it's easy and it's intoxicating, like you say, and it's new and it's exciting. And she's this kind of person who's drawn to that little hint of chaos. And ultimately, I guess, yeah, it comes to maybe regret that impulsive decision that draws her down this rabbit hole.
It's, I want to talk to you about this great cast you've got, and I'll sort of, I might bounce around, but like, I love Aisha. Dan is excellent. Josh Helman, and Chai Hansen is excellent. Laura Gordon is really fantastic, as is Luke as Axel. I think he's got kind of like a funny, weird role that like almost like his entire character is reappraised throughout the series, which I think is fantastic. And Olivia Vasquez is like your perfect. You know, I'm from Western, you know, I live in Western Sydney, and I actually, you know, so much of your series has like got a nice, like eclectic landscape of Sydney. It's not all just what people are used to seeing. And I'm just like, that is your ethnic mate. Like everyone has that mate who will like stalk someone's Instagram, call them anytime at night, they'll pick you up, like always has relationship troubles. Like that's the best ethnic mate you could possibly hope for. And like, that's who she is. And so you guys created this series when you were adapting the book, because I don't know too much about the actual original source, but like the book itself, was it set in Sydney? Was it something that was there that it was always a go-to, or was it like you guys packaged this up and said, okay, we're going to take this into Sydney, and we've got a very specific, you know, a specific aesthetic and a specific sort of cultural or cross-cultural texture that we want to add to it? Because that, like, for me, I love seeing Sydney, but like, I'd put you guys with, like, you know, that's what I love so much about Mystery in Between. It's like the anti-Sydney kind of show. And your show was like, yeah, it's contemporary Sydney and there's all these great night spots, but it's nothing unless you're a local that is recognizable. You know, I was like the Leo whistle Once Upon a Time in Hollywood meme. Like, yeah, there's, I'm like, Lidcombe, woohoo, he's in Lidcombe. Very exciting. So what was it about Sydney and this specific cast to kind of make, to manufacture this? What was your thought as creators to get to make it happen here?
I mean, the book is set in New Zealand, I think, right, Ryan? I think JP is from New Zealand originally, even though he lives in Melbourne. So the reason to set it in Sydney was, partly a practical sort of decision. That's where we made the show. But really, the big driving force behind the feel of the show was the sort of what's what I'm looking for? Like the brief that Amanda Duthy, who was head of originals at Stan, gave us is that she didn't want an erotic thriller that was lawyers and doctors in the east suburbs of Sydney, like that typical thing that you see on films. And she really wanted us to, go west, go to Cronulla, find different cultural hotspots and really make it about, I guess, like the more blue collar workers of the world. Like, why can't blue collar workers have erotic thrillers too? You know, and
Yes.
I think that was a massive inspiration in terms of how we, yeah, just started envisaging the show, but also the kinds of actors that we started looking at. Because you're right, you know, it's such an amazing cast. They're all very different in their own way, but they gel into this picture very, very organically. And yeah, they just smashed it out of the park.
I just want to talk about like Tess for a second, because that's like so great that you sort of pointed her out. My partner, I'm not, well, Alex is from Melbourne, I'm from Brisbane, so we're, you know, it's such a great compliment to hear that, you know, we've kind of in
You
some way
got
like
it. You got it. Because
captured the feeling of Sydney. But my partner, you know, in the early days of scripting, when we were talking about Tess was the only one of those principal six that wasn't in the novel. So we kind of created her whole cloth. When my partner sort of, when I was talking to her about it, she's like, oh, she's Western Sydney Sopranos. Like, that's how she phrased it, Western Sydney
Yes.
Sopranos. Like, that tough friend that will like go through hell and back with you, that is like really protective, really defensive, and just, you know, like has some fire to her, which is cool. Tess is also loosely based on, in a couple of anecdotes, on one of my best friends. And the, you know, right at the beginning of the show, when she's going through her ex's Tinder after the breakup and she's deleting his matches, that's an actual true story that I just come from my friend. I was like, that is a crazy thing for you to do, Ash, but you know, I'm definitely going to put it into a show or a movie at
out,
some point
Ash.
in my life.
Shout
Thank
out, Ash. What a legend. That's
you.
this is a whole world that I missed. This is a whole world that I missed, the Tinder world. And now I'm just marvel at those kinds of things. It's just like, what is going on? That's so great. Yeah, Western Sydney Sopranos is a great comp because also her character is great because she's like in the legal profession. So I think part of like what defines a lot of like our Mideastern sort of like diaspora across Western Sydney is like just loyalty. People who are the most loyal, awesome people in your life, and they will stalk people that they consider to be threats on Instagram and give you reports that are detailed in voice memos and whatever. Like that's the kind of person that I feel like Tess is. So yeah, I think it really works. So
And she's
when did it gel though? Because I feel like if you don't get Josh, who is excellent in this, shout out to Josh who gets the absolute piss beaten out of him in Jack Reacher, super underrated Chris Macquarie movie that I adore.
incredible.
I know he's a war boy. Yes, yeah, whatever. Like other movies, who cares? Getting the piss beaten out of him, Jack Reacher, big fan. But I think he was so excellent in this because he manages this great spectrum of like total objective desire, like completely transfixing, like, and not like so beautiful of like the Chris Hemsworth kind of mold. He's like a really relatable, like really attractive and kind of like, I don't know, he's got like a mysterious kind of something about him, bohemian something. But then he's just excellent at the this arc that you put him on. So how like critical was it to find firstly like Josh for Dan and Lena? Like I imagine those two are like, if we don't nail these guys, we're kind of stuffed.
Just starting with Dan, we initially envisaged him as completely different physically to Josh. Like,
Yes.
we kind of initially were like, oh, maybe like Dan's like kind of this very live guy. He's not sort of immediately like a regulation hottie, you know, like he speaks to Lena on maybe like a slightly more intellectual level or something like that. Like, that's going to be the nature of their connection. And then Josh walked through the door and just, it took us a second to go, oh, you know, what happens if we completely rethink this character as this very large, handsome man, but an imposing kind of physical force? And it on just on in the episode one kind of world, having this like really attractive, really masculine guy just made you sort of really buy into Lena's decision to do this impulsive thing, and that really worked. And then in the back half of the season, his physically imposing stature is something that a lot of, you know, female friends and family have spoken to me about and called out, in terms of just how terrifying that is
Oh
when that
yeah.
character shifts, and how you just fear so much for Lena being in that situation. And he uses his size, even when his words are sweet, and when he's got this deluded kind of obsessive language that he uses towards her, his physical size and his imposing stature is utterly terrifying.
Yeah, I think Josh had, you know, probably, you know, next to Aish, sort of the hardest job in the entire show, because, you know, he had to play basically like three parts at the same time.
Yes.
You know, he had to play the real Dan pretending to be the fake Dan, pretending to be a nice guy to the audience. You know, like there are so many different levels that he had to calibrate, and it's really like I don't know how he did it. It's a testament to his preparation, and it's a testament to Aish and our directors to really like hit that, you know, perfect point that you buy into him as this incredibly charming guy at the start, and by the end of it you know you're terrified of him and you despise him because he's a monster. So yeah, I don't know how he did it, and I know it was very hard, but like I think he absolutely killed it.
We had a lot of conversations with him just about Dan's psychology, and that was something that he dug into real deep, particularly in episode 5, where he sort of, where Dan talks about why he does what he does and what his perspective is on the world. You know, an episode that it felt like we had sort of the least time to shoot, you know, such a lot to accomplish and such a lot of complex stuff to get right. And he really sort of did the work, and he really knew Dan inside and out, and he really knew Dan's point of view inside and out. So full credit to him. And, you know, as he's been doing the publicity, I feel like I don't even know how he talks about this character without talking about the, you know, like the back half. I'm not sure how he's managed to sort of tread that line.
Because he's a big, beautiful, handsome man. And most of the time he's just charming the pants off anyone who's talking to him, which is completely fair and a right call. You know, he was much more, his war boy physique hid that if he just like added a few more kilos, he was like one of the most handsome guys around. And you're like, oh, look at this guy. He's freaking a really handsome guy. And then as soon as he's just something in the smile that goes from like completely alluring to this guy's a freaky, there's something not quite there that he just can command as Dan. I think that is really excellent, and that's kind of, you know, the as we were talking about before, I'm really trying, like I know we're gonna, so there are gonna be like flashes of spoilers, but I'm really trying to like say to people, I want people to watch it if they haven't had a chance, and very bingeable.
I just want to say as well with Josh that when you Google him, Scrotus from Mad Max comes up pretty early on. So let you know he's handsome, but you know that also helped us maybe to
exactly. I mean, yeah, when his previous diet was War Boy, it's nice to still surprise people. You know, like he's a bit of a mess. So Aisha, she's excellent. I thought she was just outstanding in the show, top to bottom. And I think, along with people like Laura Gordon as Claire and Luke as Axel and Chai, I thought was just, you know, again, a super tough part as Kane, but Aisha, to have that central character that like really knocked it out of the park. Like, what was that discovery like? So page one, Josh helps you rewrite Dan because you're like, wow, this gives another dimension we weren't thinking of. But how close were the lines on Aisha? Like, okay, we need someone who is like X, or was it very open?
So it took us a long time to find Lena. Like, we went through a lot of avenues, and you know, like at the topmost level, like you want, it's marquee casting. We want a performer that people that are gonna, that's going to bring people to the show.
Yeah.
So it was a really intensive search, and a couple of things I think happened when Aisha walked through the door. Firstly, you know, she is just an incredible presence. Like, before Aisha speaks a single line, audiences develop a connection to her. And it's one of these rare, indefinable things that some actors have. You know, Lena makes a lot of really complicated decisions and a lot of questionable decisions. And I think, you know, there was a certain point when we were writing the show, we're like, who you cast in this role is going to really affect the amount of sympathy that the audience has for this character. Given that so much drama comes out of the choices that she makes, and certainly Aisha sort of brings just this depth of of history to Lena that before we get into the history, which we do, you know, we do reference some of the things she's been through. Before you even get to it, I think you feel like this depth of this is a real person and she's not perfect, but she's making believable decisions.
Yeah, she finding her was, you know, like really the show, you know, like it wouldn't be the same without her. And I think in a lot of ways, she became our closest collaborator because of the insights that she was able to, you know, succinctly tell us about Lena. You know, like she at some point came up to us and said, this show is about addiction. You know, like everyone's addicted, every character in the show is addicted to their own thing. And, you know, it's just such a neat way to summarize everything to, you know, to other creators, other, you know, sort of people in the crew and to us as writers, because we're able to look at every scene and kind of go, okay, this is what we're kind of putting out into the drama, and this is what it's all about, really. So, you know, she's just got these incredible insights. And yeah, you know, like I think what you said, Ryan, you know, like she does make some questionable decisions in the show. And, you know, she was really, Aisha was really excited about that. You know, like it's rare, I think, to, you know, have a female character who, you know, does make these sort of decisions that you can still empathize with, because I think we hold female characters as viewers and audiences to a much higher standard than we do, you know, Michael Douglas or Richard Gere. So that was, I think, a really exciting challenge for her, and that was equally sort of a really important challenge for us. And it was, you know, it was difficult. There was a lot of conversations about, you know, when are we pushing her too far? When have we calibrated her to be too mean to Kane in that scene or something like that? And you're really constantly adjusting on the page, on set, and then in the edit, you know, continuously just to get that perfect line. But yeah, it's all about the performance that you get from her. And yeah, she's
And
phenomenal.
there's so much light and shade in her performance as well. Like the fact that Lena can go and Aisha can go within a couple of scenes from being, you know, what she is for the majority of the show, which is she is just this propulsive engine of action. She cannot sit still, and when there's a problem to solve, she will be on the front foot of solving that problem. She doesn't defer to other people to solve it for her. She's just go, go, go. And then the vulnerability breaks through that facade. I think it's a facade that's very realistic for paramedics and people in that industry. You know, you develop these coping mechanisms and this resilience. But I find it personally like really affecting watching her performance. Like when the facade cracks a little bit and you get to see the vulnerability underneath, and it becomes all the more affecting because of kind of how rare it is for that character.
Yeah, I think I was going to say to you guys before, there's a whole tone that comes out of the choice of making her a paramedic that it's like you have no time to make an educated decision. All you're trying to do is pause the bleeding. You know, like you literally, that's her whole life is just stop the bleeding. And you sometimes make a bad decision in the process to stop the bleeding, which causes more blood to be lost, but then you quickly make the next decision. And so what was fun is whenever Lena makes a mistake, she goes about rectifying it quite quickly, which inadvertently has then massive consequences, usually for the next episode or episodes. So you're like, oh, she's just made that decision. She thinks that's going to fix the problem, but it's actually going to make it way worse. And so she became a really fun character to watch like that, because yeah, I think you're right. In some ways, there's kind of like a pedestal that gets held up. People have this like judgment, you should know better, blah, 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 all those sort of like stupid things. Because the other thing is like, if she didn't make a whole heap of bad decisions, well, we wouldn't be watching a fun show about her trying to clean up her mess, which seems for me pretty antithetical to watching fun movies or TV shows. Like you want people to make messes, so they have to clean them up. But I just, yeah, I think that was my tone. And I think you're right on the whole addiction piece. Like everyone has something, everyone has a duty that they seem to be wanting to fulfill. But Lena's profession was the guide for me. She's literally just trying to stop the bleeding. And every time she makes a choice, which she has to make in a split second, she makes it, and it could be wrong, but then she tries to stop the bleeding again. And unfortunately, even all the way up until Josh gets his own massive No Country for Old Men DIY attempted surgery stab wound thing that he has to do, you know, the bleeding's not stopping. This is not stopping in this show.
Do you know there's nothing better than having a reference and having people get it? And
I was there's if you want to know something that I'm obsessed with, Ryan, it is DIY surgery scenes in movies.
there's nothing
Right.
more badass than DIY surgery.
There's nothing more badass. I mean, look, the Pantheon, you know, like the No Country for Old Men one is like beautiful and strange because of Javier's obviously Antoine Chigurh, but it's like you go all the way back to Rambo, like cauterizing wounds with gunpowder. You can go to like the self birth of an alien in Prometheus, which is just the one of the gnarliest ones ever, and with futuristic, you know, healing stuff. I'm a big fan of DIY surgery. So when I saw that, I'm like, he literally walks into a pharmacy, he causes a diversion, and then he gets in a towel, and there's a big attractive man trying to clean himself. I'm like, guys, who are you trying to kid? You can't pull the wool over my eyes for a second.
Too
I know this
easy.
is, I know
You
what
better
you're doing.
believe we wanted him to stuff a rag into a car, you know, oil can
Yes.
or whatever, and blow it up. We
Too many
tried, we
electric
tried.
too many electric vehicles. Too many electric vehicles these days. You would have had to have that fight. How does he blow up an electric car? But you know, yeah, look, it's really terrific. And yeah, I think you guys have done an amazing job, and it's just a riveting, completely riveting series. I had to ask, as showrunners, because this is something I often talk to directors and writers and editors and things like that, but I'm really, really grateful to talk to you guys as showrunners, because that relationship between your great director, so it's Peter Salmon and Sian Davies, who are your directors for all six episodes. They sort of do three and three. And what's your relationship like with like the tone that you're trying to set? Like, can you talk a little bit about that collaboration? Because I imagine like choosing who your directors are going to be is massive for you guys at some point, like someone who can interpret it. Obviously, your cast, you've told us so much about how that influences it, but can you tell people a little bit about like what that relationship is? Because I feel like it's such a weird thing that we don't talk about enough, because the director obviously has their own great eye and they have to work with the actors and they have to interpret what you guys are trying to achieve. But just that working relationship, I suppose, is something that never really gets talked about. So could you give us a bit of insight into that?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, you know, first and foremost, it helps when you're working just with really talented and nice people. And Peter and Sean, they're just both incredible collaborators. They, you know, came on board. You know, Peter came on board first and was really, you know, as a setup director, was responsible for helping us find the tone of the show. You know, the gaudiness of the parties, the sexiness of the eroticism, the sort of the thriller components. He was really sort of driving that conversation all the time and kind of talking to us about, you know, what's too much, what's too little in terms of how we, you know, how characters express themselves or what logic jumps were too much for the sort of the realism of the world versus the pulpiness of the world. So that was a really kind of, you know, we learned a lot from Pete from that regard because it was really up to him to find and thread that tone. And you know, Peter's a very like cerebral filmmaker. You know, he has to understand every single line of big print, every single line of dialogue. You know, he quizzes us about every single thing that's on the page so he can communicate that to the actors. And Sian, you know, she is an incredibly like dynamic filmmaker. I think that's why she was, you know, so excellent in directing the second half because there's just a lot of action, there's a lot of drama, there's a lot more, you know, running and jumping. And she was just, I think, able to achieve things on a schedule that no one had any right achieving. And I frankly, I don't know how she did it, and how the crew did it.
Yeah, it was so cool, particularly in the back half, you know, coming to the monitors on set and seeing the sort of the stuff that Sian was cooking up. Her visual storytelling is really beautiful, and the way she's able to communicate. There's a couple like key moments that jump to mind, but one is like there's a scene in episode four where Dan arrives at Claire's house and you see him through the frosted glass of the front door of, you know, of Claire's home. And it was just like such a cool shot, you know, just pushing in on that door with the looming figure behind it, being able to communicate that dread visually was, yeah, it was just awesome. And and like Alex said, I mean, just what she was able to achieve in the back half was crazy.
Yeah.
We were very ambitious with how much action and, you know, and stuff we put into the show.
Yeah, it's definitely like if I misled anyone to say like the action is it all front loaded, it doesn't know. It's just the kind of tone of the whole show, as you said, is set. But it's yeah, the back half of the series when especially when you're starting to see that people are revealing themselves to each other or being a little bit more candid. It's like it's pretty crazy. Like that, even just the dynamism of the scene with Dan, and I can't find her, this wonderful actor who does like two scenes for you. I think her name was Erin in the show. She was maybe she was the ho like the hotel cleaner slash
She's the motel
receptionist.
clerk.
Yes, the
Yeah.
motel clerk. She was just so fantastic in the scene. And as you said about his physicality, she spots him, the your great triumvirate of girls being Lena and Laura Gordon's Claire and Tess cook up this social media search for my friend thing and cause a bring a lot more attention to Dan than he wants. And they're at the hotel, they have this moment together, and she realizes that this is a guy that people are looking for. So she makes a phone call, and he discovers that she's revealing his location. He comes and into that room, and just that space using the CCTV footage, using those the different sort of the geography of that. That was incredibly
Yeah.
intense, and really affecting, perspective shots in there as well.
Yeah, and yeah, hats off to the performers for, for bringing that to life. I mean, there's kind of all these moments in the show of particularly the female characters, the moment where they realize, as we sort of talked about earlier, like when they clock something that's not right and they
Yes.
clock something that's off, and it might be a physical clue like Erin does. It might be a little moment that Laura does when she's with Dan, and she just like pulls her dressing gown a little bit closer around her, and
Yeah.
it's such a little subtle moment, but you can tell that the radar's gone off. And I think Tess even has a line saying, "My radar was always up with Dan," and yet for the good of her friend or for whatever reason, she sort of quieted those fears. And I think that's a really relatable thing for particularly a lot of women, and something that our actresses and Sean talked about, is like, when do you silence the little voice in your head, and when should you trust that and trust your instinct about the person that you're
Always,
across from?
always a little voice. Listen to the little
Yeah.
voice. If your stomach says something's off, if my nose says something's off, I'm like, no, this is not good. This is not gonna
What
work.
did I say in Seinfeld? Trust the little man, Jerry. Trust the little man. I just
I
want
just want to touch on Laura, because I think we sort of
Yes.
glossed over how incredible she is. And when we're talking about the cast, we didn't know much about Laura before we sort of started shooting. And she was actually literally the first audition tape that I saw for the entire show was her tape. And I was like, oh, cool. This is pretty
Oh,
cool.
it must have been like, oh, we're going to get some quality if this is number one.
This is number one. And, she came in and she had, at the start of the shoot, sort of probably the hardest job, because all her intense scenes were in that first 2 week period. And I feel like she was just either crying or screaming for about 2 days. And, I felt so like sorry that that was her introduction to the set. But she was so phenomenal that we basically started, because we were writing the second half of the show while we were shooting the first one, and we just started making more scenes to fit her in, because we were, she's, phenomenal. And just like including her in those scenes with Tess and in those scenes with Lena just created that spark that really, I think, brought so much to the ensemble. And yeah, just so glad that we found her. And Luke, I feel, I love Luke Cook. I feel so sad that we didn't get to use him more. When we realized that we were gonna pull the big twist at the end of episode two that rendered him useless. It was kind of like, ah, oh, that means that sort of the spark and the humor of the show has been put on ice for the last four episodes. And that was quite sad and something to get used to. But
And the
he,
balance, he had such a
yeah.
great kind of absorbent energy. Like if people were super intense, he was super silly. If people weren't being serious enough, he was like stern. If he had this great like Matt, like these people who are just super fantastic in lots of situations, because they can just be malleable and they sort of feel people's energy and they're like, oh, I'm gonna match you here. You're coming on a bit too strong. I'll go soft. You need to get fired up. And he's like, let's have some drinks or whatever. Like he's very fun. And I think that, yeah, it's like the depths of their characters kind of in the threads of the story, you kind of see that, and it all becomes, that's the more tragic elements of the story, right? It's like that this whole situation impacts a whole bunch of people's lives and they're never going to quite be the same again.
We haven't talked about Chai, and we should talk about Chai quickly as well
Oh,
to round
yeah.
out our six,
Oh,
because
yeah.
Chai is awesome, and Kane is a character who's deeply flawed, but a character that we really love. Kane really gets screwed over in this show,
Oh my
and
God, the
he
work
goes through the
so
ringer.
bad.
And because you're not sure of his motives, and because you're not sure what that character is up to, you kind of can't feel all the empathy that you feel sort of, I think, by the end of the show, and the empathy that we were feeling while we were writing those episodes. And it was just nice kind of revisiting episode six on Friday when it came out, and just seeing his resolution, and his and Lena's resolution, and the sort of the bittersweet sort of parting of ways when the two of them realize there's love here, but we're not right for each other. And can't speak highly enough of Chai as a performer to be able to play tender and frightening and intense. Like, his intensity when it gets going is just amazing.
Yeah, I think that final scene outside of the prison between Aish and Chai is probably like one of my favorite scenes because I do find it so sad and kind of satisfying at the same time. And Chai is so committed, like he literally stopped eating for about, 3 weeks safely, of course, to lose a whole bunch of weight between going to prison and coming out of prison, which I thought was just like, you'd expect that on a Hollywood film when they're, shooting stuff for a year and it's going everywhere. But like for someone to be so committed to, what we thought was like a little show being made in Australia was just like so. I don't know, it was just so gratifying, like because that takes a lot of effort that you don't get paid for, that and a lot of people might not even consciously clock on screen, but they feel it when he comes out and he's a little bit more gaunt and you just can't recreate that with any sort of makeup. And yeah, when he said that he was going to do that, I was just, blown away by his commitment. It's amazing.
He gets the
It's so
best,
cool
he
to
gets
be.
one of the best lines of the series at the end of there. And she's like, I thought I thought you'd hate me or something to the effect of, and you guys probably know the line because obviously you wrote it and you edited it and did all that. And he's like, oh, like you're probably really mad at me. He's like, oh no, I'm mad at you. Like it was just like this moment where it actually is like a laugh. It doesn't, I don't know if you guys intended it to be a laugh line, but actually it gave me like a huh, because he said exactly what the audience was feeling and thinking for him. It's like, oh no, I'm really mad at you. Like, but I'm also sad about this situation. And I feel like that's life. It's like, yeah, like I've got regrets and I'm sad. I'm really mad at you. I'm feeling all those things all at the same time. And that's a big compliment to him as an actor and a character. Like he really sells that moment. You really like him. Like that last moment you see him, you're like, oh man, this poor bastard's been put through the ringer. And we don't, it's a weird thing to be like, and I don't want him to end up with the girl. Like she, like I want him to go find like a someone who's less of a handful with the love and respect to Lena and Aisha's portrayal. I'm like, this guy just needs some peace. He's already got his mum busting his balls every 5 seconds. It's like, oh, you just need some peace, this poor guy.
A contentious point as to, with them ending up together or not ending up together. There were some people that were very keen for them to end up together, and were like, no, I don't think so.
No, I think you guys made a
I don't
perfect
think that's
choice. No,
gonna
I think the tone of the show is off. I think the more, I'm dying to talk to you guys. I'm just going to give some listeners a warning. If you've gotten this far with Ryan and Alexi show and you haven't seen all six episodes, I just for a second want you to just stop listening. Stop. And I'm going to say just 30 seconds. I'm going to get you to stop. I'm going to time it on my watch so that I can say what I need to these guys and then go forward. So 30 seconds or 45 seconds if you podcast, skip ahead. All right, you've been warned. We're going into deep spoilers. The ending of the show was magnificent. And when my wife was like, what's happened? Because again, Sean does this great, beautiful overhead shot. I just, the basement, I just filled it in. It's quite elliptical. But when she's there and there's a martini on that now like beautiful new concrete slab, speaking of Western Sydney Sopranos, I was like, I'm sure Tess's relatives filled that hole and didn't ask what was in there. They didn't ask. And that's why you need a really good ethnic friend, because they will sort you out with that kind of work. Great work, but also work that overlooks perhaps any moral decisions that you've made to hide something in there. That's not their area of concern. Love that.
Thank you. Thank
Love that.
you.
I'm like about 30 seconds run up. Appreciate that. It's definitely, yeah, it's definitely conclusive.
It's conclusive. Conclusive. For a moment, my
Yeah.
wife was like, "What's happening?" And I'm like, I just took it back for like 10 seconds, on the remote. I was like, just.
You know, like it's the biggest anxiety that I think everyone had on the entire show is that like, are people gonna get it? You know, are we being too literal or not literal enough when we kind of deliver that final line?
Oh,
And
we've got to get to your great senior. You've got to get to your great police officer, your great detective in the show. What was her name?
Brennan is the character name, and Sarah Wiseman is
Sarah
the actress.
Wiseman. Excellent. Excellent choice. She's fantastic. More of her as a detective. Great. Hire her for
Spin-off
more things.
perhaps, I don't
I don't know. Yeah,
know.
like hell yeah. I'm a crime film guy of all shapes and sizes, and I'm like a good detective, especially a blousy, attractive, and also extremely capable and tough female detective. I'm like, yes. And especially because all these characters feel so comfortable with her, because obviously she can empathize in a way that's so deep and instinctual on a lot of these situations. And I feel like, just speaking of a smell test, she kind of like she's got everyone's number a second after they walk in the door, which is so fantastic. But that whole scene as it's playing out, she's like, yeah, I just feel, I just buried it, and it's just great. I just really liked it. Anyway, I hope I haven't spoiled anything if you guys like fast forwarded 30 seconds, but it's just a great ending to a show. Yeah, sorry, please, Alexa, go. About being too literal or too elliptical in your endings.
No, it's always this line between clarity and no, what is it? Mystery and confusion. You know,
Yes.
one is good and one is bad. And I, you know, how Ryan and I work together is I've always leant more on the take more out and perhaps leave people confused than mystified. And thankfully, Ryan's always been, no, I think we're taking out too much. And I think writing that scene and all the various permutations of that line, it was this constant debate about like, people are going to get it. Are we being too lame and literal with it? You know, everyone's going to have their own opinion ultimately in the end because everyone's going to find it sort of differently. But I'm relieved that most of the people that I speak to understand what happened because, if everyone didn't, I think we'd be in trouble.
Yeah, I think it definitely plays. How are you guys feeling now that it's over? Have you had any fun responses? Any family members, friends have given you any kind of fun responses, in just the immediate way? Because we're talking a couple of days after the final episode aired. So, what's your favorite reaction so far?
My favorite reaction is my friends that are pitching me season two ideas as we speak. I have very like, you know, filmy friends and, you know, growing up, we've always talked about like, how would you do an X-Men movie or whatever? You know, how would you approach this? What could we have done differently? And it's interesting hearing people, you know, hearing a couple of people in particular going through the process, being like, I wonder what season two is going to be like. And then getting to the end and being like, I really wonder what season two could be like.
Yes. Is
I
there a
think
season two? Is that an unfair question for me to say? It's like it feels like this would be an anthology series. Is that the best phraseology of that thing? Of like, there's a someone who
yeah.
is doing something like this, and you guys can set it at another time, or another group of friends, another part of the country, for example, and then maybe a carryover character kind of. Who is entangled gets entangled. I don't know. I maybe it's more of the like cultural imperialism of Britain that has come to Australia, of me like being completely and utterly satisfied with six episodes of a fantastic show, or two seasons of said show that like are fitting into the same world, and then being like, okay, I'm good. Like, I'm gonna go back and watch your show again. I don't care if there's another series. It's just like, I liked that experience, and I'd like to kind of dig into it a little bit.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I think our approach was to put everything on the page with season one because you never know if you're going to get to
Of
make another season
course.
again.
Of course.
You know, having said that, you know, like there's plenty of other stuff that we want to do with our characters, so you know, we're going to give it our best shot
Oh,
and see what
that's
happens.
amazing. I'm excited to see where it goes because again, I think that you leave everyone with the same challenge of that you did at the end of episode two, which is where the hell are they going to go from here? Where are they going to go? I have one funny question because this show is obviously watching you is all about a kind of creepy Airbnb sort of like otherworldly adjacent place that a very dodgy individual in this moment has gone and put a lot of these peeping Tom cameras in, got touches of Sliver, shout out Sliver, in it. And I just love what your directors did to film these random people. And I just wondered how, what was, did you guys, is there like Easter eggs or friends at like homes or kitchens that you shot in there? 'Cause like there's these, sometimes these huge screens of like to show just the, I guess the breadth of this guy's obsession and craziness of all these different homes, all these different things. Was there anything in there that you guys had fun with? 'Cause I'm like, I'm sure that like Alexi and Ryan have one of their mates' houses in there. Someone's having a fake argument, their mum or dad, their grandma, like, you know, just something in there. Was there anything in there that like for people who are going to go back and revisit the show to look out for? Was there anything in there you snuck in there?
Absolutely. What I will say is, pay close attention to a guy making a martini. No, making a margarita
A
in one of the.
margarita. Ah.
You might see a couple of familiar faces.
Hell yeah. Hell yeah. I'm gonna go back and find that.
Something on the on those lines that I just was thinking about the other day as well. We put an Easter egg into the first episode of the show, and it's in the scene where Lena meets Tess at the bar. And I would encourage people to watch that scene really closely and see if they can spot an Easter
I'm gonna see if I can find it. But
egg.
yeah, 'cause like that's the feeling I get with you guys in the layering of the story. I'm like, when you're telling such a visually dynamic story that has so many different POVs, right? And that's what I love. You know, I love when, and I'm sure you guys feel this as cinephiles and film fans, it's just like I love when a camera adopts a surveillance POV. And feeling the feelings that it gives you. And it doesn't necessarily mean that it's gonna be part of the scene. Sometimes it's not like an artifact in the scene that then just adopts that thing to show you something. You know, it's not like it's not always like Snatch where, you know, poor Tyrone is like in the bookies and it goes up and adopts that view so that, you know, Bricktop can go and hunt him down or whatever. It's not just like that. It's adopting that for a very specific thing to make you feel like a character is being surveilled. So when I was watching it, I was like, oh, well, these guys must have had to have fun with, you know, creating this sense at some point. So, you know, as these different things are going, I'm like, I'm thinking about how this is all going to play.
Yeah, I think like, you know, we didn't want to do too much of like the kind of standard CCTV, you know, camera in the
Yeah.
corner sort of stuff. So we were like, okay, well, what's around us? You know, it's doorbells, it's phones, it's, you know, little things that you can stick
It's lamps, it's
on a
light
lamp.
fittings.
It's
Yeah, all
it's
those
all
things.
those things. And, you know, we kind of just went, okay, well, let's like try to imbue that into the language of the show. Ironically, the most sort of surveillance, my favorite surveillance shot in the entire show is the peephole shot
Yeah.
that Sean filmed, where Lena comes up right to the door the moment before she walks through the door to meet Dan. I just think it's such a, you know, it's both like a beautiful and incredibly like uneasy shot, and it's got nothing to do with technology, but it does convey everything that, you know, the show kind of says about, you know, watching and how uneasy it is. And yeah, it's yeah, I love that shot, and I'm so glad we kind of got to keep it because for a while, you know, I
It was
think
nearly
we
on the floor.
weren't going to.
But I think also it's just part of, I think in the surveillance shooting that you see, it's very controlled and very composed, which is why you can see that there's an obsessive mind behind it because there's kind of a curatorial. I want this particular perspective of this place. I want the kitchen. I want this overhead shot in a bedroom. I want this thing. So it's like, it's not just about seeing people in an unguarded way. It's also about having this beauty, like creating a scene for them, this manufacturing of a scene. So even in its like lack of artifice, it's artifice. So it's fun. But then that uncomfortable proximity of not being aware that you're filmed and you're so close to it, or you're being watched that you're so close to it, you're going to run into the person that's watching you or into a mechanism that they're watching you with. I think that that is, there's just those flourishes in the show that I think work really well. Guys, I just want to thank you so much. Thank you so much for chatting to me. You've done an amazing job. If season two happens, I'm sure you guys, based on just completely backing yourselves into a corner, I think that may just be a good technique for you guys. Completely screw yourself with like a third act twist and be like, let's bring it to the end of the first act and see what happens after this. We can write ourselves out of this problem. I think you did a great job. I love the series, and I think your actors were amazing, your directors were, and I just, yeah, it was a really enjoyable to watch, like a very adult, fun, crime, twisty, psychosexual thriller, and it's something that I'm going to really recommend, which is why I wanted to talk to you guys. So just thank you so much for taking the time to talk to me.
Thanks so much for having us. Appreciate the chat.
Thanks, Blake. It's been awesome.